This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Conventional wisdom has it that many of the world's problems, and not least those of the Middle East, are a direct consequence of the exploitation, racism, and violence of colonialism. The word empire is redolent of slavery, war, and arrogance, and no empire is more harshly judged than the biggest and most successful of them all. Almost everyone accepts that the British Empire shaped the modern world. British historian Neil Ferguson is among a contrarian few who argue that, on balance, this was a good thing. Neil Ferguson is the author of a new book and television series called Empire, The Rise and Demise of the British World Order and Lessons for Global Power. Amid the admitted blemishes of empire, he emphasizes the spread of capitalism, the institution of parliamentary democracy, the notion of humanitarianism, increased education, global communication, and the idea of liberty. In other words, he credits the British Empire for pushing the world into the modern age. In this first part of our conversation, we'll focus on history, and then we'll extend the conversation to the lessons that the British Empire may have to impart to the new American Imperium. Later in the program, we'll look at American and British warnings to Syria about its behavior and your letters. But first, how did a small island off the coast of Europe come to dominate so much of the world? What was the legacy of what Professor Ferguson calls Anglobalization? And why did the British Empire eventually collapse? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Neil Ferguson joins us now from our bureau in New York. He's an economic historian by trade, teaches at New York University and Jesus College, Oxford. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
It's nice to be here, Neil.
You argue very persuasively that the British Empire started as an exercise in Elizabethan piracy. Explain, if you would.
Well, nobody really set out to create a British Empire. As the Victorians used to joke, it was the product of a fit of absence of mind. And its early phase in the later 16th century and early 17th century was really a kind of smash-and-grab exercise, trying to find gold, as the Spanish and Portuguese had in their much earlier imperial forays, failing to find it, and then resorting to stealing it. And so I try to portray the early empire as a sort of good fellas operation run by gangsters like Henry Morgan with a kind of nominal license from England to run amok against England's foes, particularly Spain, but no great strategic purpose beyond that.
I have to say, with your accent, a good fellas doesn't come out quite the same.
Well, you see, I'm a classic product of a particular ethnic group that was disproportionately involved in this empire building, namely the Scots. They were much more likely to settle overseas in what became British colonies. The Celtic periphery generated a very crucial part of what I've called Anglobalization. So forgive the accent, it's an integral part of the story.
Well, one of the key points in your book is, in fact, that Britain was always involved in sending millions of its people overseas, the Scots and Irish, most famously. But in that early colonial period that you're talking about, post-Jamestown, certainly, many more went to the sugar islands of the Caribbean and then to the unprofitable hardscrabble farms of Virginia.
Yes, I mean, Virginia was a particularly unpromising place until they figured out they could grow tobacco there. The mortality rate was very high for early settlers. New England turned out to be a great deal healthier, but in economic terms, New England was of far less interest, even as late as the 1770s, than the sugar-producing islands of the Caribbean. It's one argument why the British didn't fight as hard as they might have fought to keep the 13 colonies, that at that particular moment it didn't seem to be as economically important to hold on to North America as to hold on to Jamaica and the other sugar-producing colonies. Sugar was where the big money was in the 18th century. I argue that it was a kind of glucose rush that fueled British empire building in the 18th century. And I think when you put it in that perspective, America's colonial history, and after all, the United States was a product, not just of a revolt against the empire, but of the empire itself. Mm-hmm. Its history looks a lot different.
The sugar rush, but the other big commodities that needed to be shipped around the world, tea and tobacco.
Right, and so you've got a fantastic cocktail of new drugs going round. Nicotine and caffeine were enormously important to kick-starting 17th and 18th century British economic expansion. And it's really the consumption of those goods in Britain and then in secondary markets in Europe that makes the British Empire so profitable in its early phase.
Hmm. Now, you talk about the spread of these millions of people exported from Britain around the world in a chapter you title White Plague.
Well, I think it was a plague from the point of view of indigenous populations on the receiving end of it. And I want to emphasize before any of your listeners become irate that the good things I have to say about the British imperial project really all come from the 19th and early 20th centuries. I'm absolutely clear and explicit about the bad things in the 17th and 18th century. And the bad things, of course, included wiping out or expelling forcibly indigenous populations, not only in North America, but also in Australia. And, of course, enslaving millions of Africans in order to provide labor for the sugar plantations. I mean, this isn't a pretty story. The early empire is red of tooth and claw, and I don't make any bones about that.
And the institution, of course, of slavery. You tell us the story of John Newton, a devout clergyman, the composer of a very famous hymn, Amazing Grace, and a man who, you point out, after his religious awakening, spent 6 years as a slave trader.
Yes, it's an interesting story. Most people know the Amazing Grace hymn in some form or another. Very few people know that its composer was in fact engaged in the slave trade. And those who do know that often believe that he had a religious conversion and then left the slave trade. And it isn't true. In fact, he continued to be involved in the slave trade some years after his religious rebirth. And he writes about this in some fascinating journals and letters, which I quote from in the book. And the point, of course, that I'm trying to convey is that in the minds of evangelical Christians in the mid-18th century, there was nothing incompatible between devout Christianity and enslaving Africans. And Newton's rationalization of this to his wife is that the Africans have no conception of liberty. It's something they simply don't understand. He also says they don't understand love. He sees them really as inhabiting a completely different cultural universe from himself. What's fascinating is that he then, later in life, comes to see that this simply can't be compatible with Christian doctrine, and he becomes one of the leading lights of the anti-slavery campaign. So in his very life, you get this extraordinary cultural shift from slavery to anti-slavery, which I think is one of the defining moments of British imperial history.
Our telephone number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN@npr.org. We're talking with economic historian Neil Ferguson about his new book, Empire, The Rise and Demise of the British World Order and the Lessons for Global Power. And let's go to the phones. Our first caller is Jeff, who joins us from Seattle.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
Yeah, I want to sort of agree, but maybe push a little harder on your guest's point that colonialization and all the thought lines of that era that made it seem okay to do these things are still at work and seem to have a new impetus under the current president. But it was necessary for the British to deindustrialize India in order that they could then control the textile market. I mean, for instance, the largest textile production in the world in the 1600s was Madras in India. And the Brits didn't want the competition, and they didn't out-compete them. They militarily destroyed the Madras textile mills, and I think that's an allegory for our takeover of Iraq, and in order that we can control that oil, and that oil will not be used locally to sort of change the control of industrialization of the industrial capacity of Iraq to the United States from Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Now,
Jeff, can I come back there? It's a fantastically important point that you make, and it's not one that I duck in the book. It's clear that industrially, India was way ahead of Britain. When you look at the stop the clock in 1700 and ask which power is the more economically important in the world, it's India by far. And so the question is, what went wrong with the Indian economy, and can we blame it all on exploitative British behaviour? Well, clearly it's in large measure that. But it's important to bear in mind that there were things about the Indian textile industry that weren't entirely promising, technologically particularly. And there's an important book by an Indian economic historian, Tirthankar Roy, which argues that even if the British had not gone into India with military force in the second half of the 18th century, it's unlikely that the Indian textile industry would have held its dominant position as Western Europe industrialized. The story that India is, quote, deindustrialized by force majeure, by British imperial power, thinks it does in fact need to be qualified. And in many ways, the Indian technology was almost obsolescent at that point. And it's inconceivable, I think, that India would have made the leap to the modern technologies of the 19th century without British investment and British rule.
Next caller is Dominic, who's with us from, I'm taking it, this is from the University of California in Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's great. Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my name is Dominic Thomas. I teach at UCLA, and I'm teaching post-colonial and also colonial studies. And I'm absolutely outraged, and I think that Professor Ferguson sort of anticipated this type of call at the beginning. If you look at late colonialism under British rule or under French rule, it seems that Ferguson's argument here is sort of justifying that the ends justify the means. I would argue that neither the means nor the ends themselves speak very well for the circumstances of colonialism and post-colonialism in Africa itself. If we look at the roots of ethnic rivalry, genocide, and dictatorship formation in the African continent, so much of this goes back to the very structures that were there under colonial rule that were set up according to this sort of modernity-based argument that premised that the incorporation of African countries, for example, into the modern world was somehow some kind of necessary example. If you look at the pre-colonial era, there are many examples of successful forms of government, networks of trade, and so on and so forth. And I think that clearly most of the interesting work that's been done on colonialism in recent years talks about the devastating impact that colonialism had on the African continent. And I have to echo those views.
Well, Dominic, it's always nice to hear outraged left-wing historians, particularly when they're teaching at UCLA. I wonder whether you're really positing your argument on a realistic counterfactual. What you're saying is that African economic development would somehow have been more successful and the growth path would have been higher if it hadn't been for Britain's involvement. Let me introduce an important qualification here, which you, in common with most critics of colonialism, don't make. You don't distinguish between the different European forms of colonialism. And there's a world of difference between the way the British operate and the way the Belgians operated, or rather the Belgian royal family operated in Belgian Congo. We need to draw these distinctions. The economic development of Southern Africa wasn't without its human cost, but I don't think anybody could pretend that South Africa's economic progress wasn't ultimately helped by the huge amounts of investment. Can I just finish it? By the huge amounts of investment that were brought to it by British capitalists. Now, of course, it's not a beautiful sight, and human lives were lost, and I don't make any secret of that, and I don't whitewash Cecil Rhodes at all in the book. But I think the key point one has to ask oneself is, well, what are the counterfactuals? One counterfactual for Southern Africa in the late 19th century was a Zulu empire. Are you telling me, Dominic, that a Zulu empire would have brought about higher per capita GDP in South Africa? I don't think so.
I think the fundamental difference between the ways in which I'm quantifying your ends and means argument is that you're looking at economics. I'm looking at human beings.
Dominic, we're not going to answer this before we get to the break, so I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll resume one more go-round after the break, okay?
Great. Thank you very much.
I'm just going to put Dominic on hold, and Neil Ferguson's with us from our bureau in New York. We're talking about his new book, Empire, The Rise and Demise of the British World Order and the Lessons for Global Power. We'll take more of your calls, particularly on the aspect of what the British Empire may have to teach the American Empire, which, as Neil Ferguson describes it, is an empire in denial that dares not speak its name. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Neil Ferguson, historian and the author of Empire, The Rise and Demise of the British World Order and the Lessons for Global Power. How do we define empire? What lessons can the American superpower learn from the British experience? And if the U.S. is indeed an empire, what are the responsibilities that come with that role? You're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And first of all, let's finish up with Dominic, who's on the phone with us from UCLA. And Dominic, you were just coming back to Professor Ferguson.
No, I was just saying, I mean, to be in all respect, I think the fundamental difference between Professor Ferguson's argument and my positionality on this issue here is that I don't believe that gross domestic product is a way of gauging the success of any kind of country or historical space. I'm looking at human beings here. I'm thinking about the impact of colonialism on human beings, not as in colonialism as a successful way of incorporating Africa into a kind of global capitalist market. That's not the way, I think, of determining the ways in which colonialism was successful. And that's what I find so problematic with this type of argument.
Well, this is a fantastically idealistic and, if I may say so, naive way of making distinctions. You cannot measure human welfare without economics being in there. It's simply absurd to make a distinction between these things because, apart from anything else, rising per capita GDP correlates positively with rising health, correlates positively with almost any other measure of well-being that you'd care to name. And I think that the trouble about Dominic and his colleagues who work in post-colonial and colonial studies is that they just don't read the economics literature. And what that shows you is that if you pursue a policy of economic openness, introduce structures of legal certainty, contract law, and effective courts, operate a fiscal and monetary system which is basically attractive to investment, then large quantities of capital are likely to flow from the rich world to the poor world. And that is exactly what happened in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Indeed, it happened much more then than it currently does. And that's why in 1960, at the end, in the closing phase of British rule, a country like Zambia, Northern Rhodesia, was on an income of around 1/7 of British incomes. In other words, British incomes were about 7 times what they were in Zambia. Today, after independence, after 43 years of independence, the differential is of the order of a factor of 28. In other words, independence has had the effect of impoverishing the people of Zambia. Why? Because under independent governments, most of sub-Saharan Africa has not had economic openness, it has not had the rule of law, it has had a completely corrupt system of administration, and it's clear that what dictators like Robert Mugabe tried to blame on colonialism, and it's always depressing to hear Western academics endorse their position, is in fact a direct consequence of corrupt, independent governance. When you make the economic argument, it's pretty clear that although there were heavy costs to empire, and I don't understate those, there were substantial benefits, and the benefits were much greater for most Africans than the benefits of independence have been.
Dominic, we will concede that you could come back on this, and you guys could go back and forth all day long, but we wanted
Absolutely.
To give some other people a chance. But we appreciate
Great. Thanks
the
for having,
call.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, appreciate
Bye-bye.
It.
Bye-bye.
And Neil Ferguson, one of the parallels you draw from the British military experience in Iraq back in 1917 might sound a little familiar to the U.S. position today. Here's a quote you took from a proclamation issued to the people of Mesopotamia by the then victorious British commander F.S. Maud.
Our armies do not come into your cities and lands as conquerors or enemies, but as liberators. Your wealth has been stripped of you by unjust men. The people of Baghdad shall flourish under institutions which are in consonance with their sacred laws.
And that could, with some modern brushing up, have come out of the mouth of General Tommy Franks, could it have not?
Quite so, and I think anybody who knows anything about British imperial history is having déjà vu and double déjà vu, because of course we did exactly the same thing during the Second World War in 1941 when a pro-German Iraqi leader tried to install himself in power. This is actually the third time in less than a century that British armies have swept through Iraq and taken over the control of the country. And in that sense, you could regard this really as the third chapter in the history of the Anglobalization of Iraq.
And the difference, one of the differences you write about, though, is that when General Maud was making that statement, he then went on to say that, and of course our armies will be leaving you to your own devices fairly soon, but never meant it.
I think this is the big distinction that I would draw between the nascent American Empire, I know we're not supposed to call it that, but it looks like that to me, and the British Empire 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. The British well understood that if they were going to create the institutions for effective, stable market economics and some ultimate future transition to representative government, it was going to take time. After all, if you consider that Iraq came under British control in 1918, and that the British were still there informally running the place as late as 1958. That's a good 40 years. And that, of course, is a short time period by the standards of most British colonies. I mean, if you add up the period of time the British ruled over the average colony, it's more like 100 to 150 years. Whereas the time frame in the minds of the American administration today for the occupation of Iraq ranges between 3 months and 2 years. Nobody seems prepared to look much beyond a two-year time horizon. And in my view, that's completely irresponsible, because there's simply no way that a country that's been as systematically impoverished and deprived of legal institutions as Iraq has been since 1979 is going to turn around and become a model democracy before the next U.S. presidential election. It's complete fantasy.
Our next caller is Philip, who joins us from San Francisco.
Hi, how are you doing, Neil?
Okay.
Yeah, I grew up in Hong Kong, and that was a former British colony. And my father's from Macau, a former Portuguese colony. And I think that, you know, that the British, you know, aspect of running it, the, you know, colonialism is fantastic.
So it was, in your experience, a good thing?
I think it's a great thing. I mean, you look at countries, in America, it's a former British colony, Australia, New Zealand, and you have Singapore, you have Hong Kong, and you have the best railroad system in the world, which is in India. It's all British.
But those ideas of liberty, the British reserved those for themselves and didn't get around to giving it to Hong Kong until, what, 6 months before they left?
Well, I mean, they did do a lot. I mean, I am of mixed, you know, my father is Portuguese and my mother is English, and yes, Portuguese weren't looked, you know, they weren't sort of looked that well upon in Hong Kong, but I just see what Hong Kong is now and what it has become. I mean, it's become a financial powerhouse, and all of that because of, you know, of British colonialism.
I think Philip makes a very important point here, that we need to distinguish between the institutions that promote successful economic development and democracy on a one-person, one-vote basis. The British always made it clear that their ultimate objective was a transition to representative government, maybe not full-scale democracy, but certainly parliamentary structures like they had back in England. But the time horizon varied according to, as they saw it, the level of economic development of the countries that they ruled over. It's easy, of course, to sneer at that and say, well, the British were never serious about democratizing, say, India or Hong Kong. But in the case of somewhere like India, immediately after the First World War, there were steps taken in the direction of local responsible government with elected assemblies. I don't think the British were entirely insincere about this. And even if they were entirely insincere in the case of Hong Kong, or let's just put it this way, rather absent-mindedly, never quite got round to introducing representative assemblies, you can't argue with the economic results.
Definitely.
There are few economies of magnitude in world history that have performed as badly as the Chinese economy performed between around 1820 and 1970. It really was an economy which simply declined and declined and declined and impoverished and indeed starved to death millions. There is one exception to the rule of Chinese economic failure, and it's Hong Kong. And that has to be because British institutions were in place there rather than Chinese institutions. I can't see any argument with that.
Well, Philip, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email we got from Gary Meyer. I've always wondered if the modern communications of telephone, TV, etc. would have enabled the British Empire to continue. If we had the instant communications of TV, telephone, etc. earlier in the life of the empire, would it have tied it together more tightly and given it more of a sense of unity and common purpose?
It's a great question, Gary. Actually, the Victorians had their own communications revolution, which in many ways was more dramatic and more impressive than even those we've witnessed in our own time. By laying a network of cross-ocean cables, of telegraph wires, the British were able to create their own, if you like, their own internet. And this transformed the journey time of intelligence from, let's say, a couple of months across the Atlantic to literally minutes. So in a sense, in relative terms, it was a bigger leap forward than anything we've seen in our own lifetimes. Plus, of course, let's not forget railways and the extraordinary explosion of steam power at sea. I think the world shrank more in relative terms in the 19th century than it has in our lifetimes. And it did so mainly because of British technology, because nearly all the telegraph connections were laid by British companies, and most of the great steamship routes were plied by British sailing companies. So it's actually quite an extraordinary story. In a way, there are close parallels with our own age. This Victorian communications revolution brought about, in the words of one contemporary, the annihilation of distance. The Victorians had a sense that they really could communicate from Calcutta to London in a matter of hours by the 1880s. And I think in that sense, your question's a good one, but the Victorians answered it.
Hmm. Compare the two empires, if you will, if we accept that there is an American empire, in other ways. Both Britain at the pinnacle of its power and the United States currently enjoy both military and economic dominance.
I think that's right, Neil, but in many ways there are some important differences. For example, in terms of raw economic power, the United States is much bigger than Great Britain ever was, even at its greatest. I guess the US accounts for about between a fifth and a quarter of world output today, whereas Britain at peak barely broke through the 10% barrier. And in military terms, too, the United States is further ahead of the competition than Britain ever was. British naval dominance was always being challenged by rival empires, not least the German Empire, and the British never really had the kind of land forces that, say, the Russians were able to deploy. So I would say that on some points, the United States is already ahead of the British Empire in terms of global power. But there are a couple of really crucial distinctions to be made. The first is that, as you said earlier, the British exported Britons. They exported people in their millions. It was a settler-based empire, whereas, of course, the United States today hoovers in immigrants, and it does so almost as much as it did 100 years ago when it was still the world's great emerging market. And the second point is that the British exported in net terms colossal quantities of their capital, invested it in those parts of the world that they governed. And the United States today hoovers up foreign capital. It's a net importer of capital, and you could say that American living standards today depend very heavily on the willingness of foreigners to invest in the US, which is a very big difference. It means that, in a way, the world's biggest power is the world's biggest debtor, whereas 100 years ago, the world's biggest power, Britain, was the world's biggest creditor.
And go back to the phones. Our next caller is Ruel, who's with us from Los Angeles.
Hello, good afternoon. I'm basically calling just to ask Mr. Ferguson about what price he could put on the fact that as a people, as a Chicano here in Los Angeles, we have lost our original language, we have lost our ceremonies, our songs, our land base, and many more, you know, that I could go into because of colonization. My question to him is, what got into these people's heads to feel the justification to go in and to just obliterate and just basically exploit people? Like, what was so wrong about their little island, you know, that they just had this unquenchable thirst for more? And that's pretty much it. You know, I just wanted to say also that I guess with denial and materialism, this way of thinking will always exist and keep on going, and I hope that we heal this earth. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Ruel.
I, I'm afraid I probably am a dreadful materialist, and I make only a modest and limited apology for that, because as an economic historian, I can't help but concern myself with economic questions. And the answer to your question, if you want to take us back to the story of the great explosion of British settlement in the beginning of the 17th century and carrying on right up to the 1950s, it has a primarily economic explanation. There was a serious problem of population density, particularly on the Celtic periphery, Ireland and Scotland of the British Isles. And those people took one look at the relatively thinly populated North American continent, Australian continent, and they made the calculation that land was going to be cheap there and their labor would be more rewarded because they would be in shorter supply. It was a pretty straightforward calculation, and it was correct. Most of the demographic disaster that befell the American Native Americans in North America was not, in the first phase, caused deliberately by settlers. It was an accidental consequence of the diseases that they brought with them. And the epidemics that devastated the populations of, say, Massachusetts struck the British, who arrived, as providential, because, of course, it cleared the land for them. But it wasn't exactly something that they set out to achieve. Certainly thereafter, there was violence between indigenous populations and the settlers. And I've argued in the book that we have to ask a question why that violence occurred and why there wasn't more peaceful coexistence. Why, for example, there wasn't intermarriage like there was on a very large scale in Latin America. And that is an extremely important question that tells us something about the nature of British settlement. It was, in a sense, always quite a racist project, although nobody, of course, used a term like that then, in the sense that the intention was to replicate British culture, not to mix with indigenous cultures. And one can't say that that was anything other than a morally bad thing with terrible human consequences. The economic consequences, though, are absolutely impossible to argue with. The most dynamic, successful economies of the period after British settlement were the colonies where the British settled, not just what became the United States, but Canada, New Zealand, Australia. These were the fastest growing economies in the world.
We just have a minute left, but I wanted to ask David Robert Hunter's email question. Wouldn't your guest agree that the American occupation, i.e. our empire, is not by military armies or governors from the mother country, but rather by Coke, Nike, and McDonald's?
Well, the British, of course, had their soft power, if you want to use that phrase. They had their cultural exports. Think of the extraordinary popularity of association football. They had their missionaries preaching evangelical Christianity. That caught on with extraordinary consequences in sub-Saharan Africa. And so, in a sense, there was a parallel kind of purely material, purely consumer-driven economic imperialism in the 19th century, too. My sense is that that's not enough by itself. There are plenty of Islamic fundamentalists committed to the destruction of the United States who wear Nike running shoes when planning their operations. It's perfectly possible to buy and drink Coca-Cola and hate the United States. So the UK was always interested not only in soft power, but in hard power.
Neil Ferguson, thanks very much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, Neil.
Neil Ferguson, the author of Empire, The Rise and Demise of the British World Order and the Lessons for Global Power. He joined us from our bureau in New York. After the break, Syria feels the rhetorical wrath of the Bush administration. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.